Turning immediately from the temple gate, I took a late coach to Covent Garden and there found a hotel for the night. I could not sleep. Whatever night fancies and noises crowded in on me, they never warded off the don't go home of the note. At 7 the next morning, I was on my way to Wemmick at Woolworth.
Hello, Mr. Pip. You did come home, then. I left a note for you at each of the gates on the chance.
I came in at the Whitechapel.
I'll go round the others and destroy the notes tomorrow. Never leave documentary evidence. I'm going to take a liberty with you. Would you mind toasting this sausage for the aged pea?
Delighted.
Then you can go about your work, Mary Ann. Which leaves us to ourselves, don't you see, Mr. Pip?
I much appreciate your friendship and caution.
Now we are in our private and personal capacities. I accidentally heard yesterday morning, being in a certain place where I once took you, that a certain person, not altogether of uncolonial pursuits, and not unpossessed of portable property, I don't know who it may really be, we won't name this person.
Not necessary.
Had made some little stir in a certain part of the world, where a good many people go, not always in gratification of their own inclinations, and not quite irrespective of government expense, by disappearing from such place, and being no more heard of thereabouts. I also heard that you at your chambers in Garden Court Temple had been watched, and might be watched again.
By whom?
I wouldn't go into that. It might clash with official responsibilities. I heard other curious things in the same place. I don't tell it you on information received. I heard it.
This watching of me at my chambers is inseparable from the person you have just been...
Either it is, or it will be. I can't say more.
I would like to ask you a question, if you feel it would be right.
Hmm?
You have heard of a man of bad character, whose true name is Compeyson.
Hmm?
Is he living?
Hmm?
Is he in London?
Mm-hmm. Now, questions being over, I come to what I did on hearing the aforesaid. I went to Garden Court and, finding you out, went to Clatticker's to find Mr. Herbert and gave him to understand that if he was aware of anybody, Tom, Jack or Richard, being about the chambers, he'd better get said Tom, Jack or Richard out of the way while you were out of the way.
Where would be safe?
Mr. Pip, I'll tell you something. Under existing circumstances, there is no place like a great city when you're once in it. Don't break cover too soon. Lie close. Wait till things slacken before you try the open, even for foreign air.
Thank you. What has Herbert done?
He mentioned to me, as a secret, he was courting a young lady who has a pa, which pa lies abed in a bow window where he can see the ships sail up and down the river. You're acquainted with the young lady, most probably?
No. She sees me as an expensive companion who does Herbert no good.
The house with the bow window, and being kept by a very respectable widow, a Mrs. Wimple, has a furnished upper room to let. Mr. Herbert put it to me, what did I think of that as a temporary tenement for Tom, Jack, or Richard?
Wonderful.
For three reasons. It's altogether out of your beats. Without going near it yourself, you could always hear of the safety of Tom, Jack, or Richard through Mr. Herbert. And three, after a while, and when it might be prudent, if you should want to slip Tom, Jack, or Richard on board a foreign packet boat, there he is, ready.
Oh, thank you, thank you.
By 9 o'clock last night, Mr. Herbert had housed the said Tom, Jack, or Richard quite successfully, giving out at the old lodgings he was summoned to Dover. What's best is, it was done without you. Now, here's the address. There can be no harm in you going there tonight and seeing for yourself. But after you've gone home, don't go back there.
Mr. Wemmick, thank you again.
Avail yourself of this evening to lay hold of his portable property. You don't know what may happen to him. Don't let anything happen to the portable property. I must be off. You look very much worried. Have a perfectly quiet day with the aged. You'll be up presently, and have a little bit of... You remember the pig?
Of course.
Have a little bit of him. That sausage you roasted was his, and he was in all respects a first-rater. Do try him, if only for old acquaintance sake.
The aged and I enjoyed one another's company by falling asleep before Wemmick's fire more or less the whole day. Then, when it was quite dark, I left the aged preparing the fire for toast, and I inferred from the number of teacups, as well as from his glances at the two little doors in the wall, that Miss Skiffins was expected. All the waterside region of the upper and lower pool before the bridge was unknown ground to me. I was looking for Chink's Basin on Mill Pond Bank. Surprisingly, it was a fresh kind of place where the wind from the river had room to turn itself round, and there were two or three trees in it. And then, at last, a house with a wooden front and three stories of bow windows, Mrs. Wimple's. It was an odd sensation to see Herbert's familiar face quite at home in that very unfamiliar place.
All is well, Handel, and he is quite satisfied, though eager to see you. My dear girl is with her father. That's him. All the provisions he keeps in his room. A man with gout in his right hand through rum, trying to cut a double Gloucester. Clara has no relation in the world but old Gruff and Grim.
That's his name?
No, Barley. Handel, Clara.
Mr. Pip?
A very pretty, slight, dark-eyed girl of 20 or so had entered, whom Herbert tenderly relieved of a basket.
Look here. Here's poor Clara's supper served out every night. Bread, her slice of cheese, her rum, which I drink.
Hey! Papa wants some, darling.
There was something so natural and winning in Clara that I would not have undone the engagement between her and Herbert for all the money in the pocketbook I had never opened. As Clara ran off to no doubt pour rum into her father, Herbert took me to see our charge, to whom I resolved not to mention the name Compeyson. Do you trust Wemmick's judgment and sources of information?
Aye, dear boy. Jaggers knows.
Then, I have talked with Wemmick, and have come to tell you what cautions he gave me and what advice.
Aye.
He's heard, in Newgate, my chambers have been watched. Wemmick recommends keeping close for a time, and I'm to stay away from you. When the best time comes, you should go abroad. I will come with you.
My coming back was a venture. I'll do nothing, dear boy, and Pip's comrade, to make it a desperate venture.
Handel, I've been considering. We are both good watermen. We could take Mr. Campbell...
That's me.
...down the river ourselves when the right time comes. That way no boat would be hired. No boatman. So it would save at least one chance of suspicion. Don't you think it might be a good thing if you began now to keep a boat at the Temple Stairs and be in the habit of rowing up and down the river? Then who notices or minds? Do it 20 or 50 times and there is nothing special in your doing it the 20 or 51st.
Aye. It's good. Pip's comrade.
You must never recognise us if we come below bridge.
But pull down the blind on the east window when you see us, and all is right.
Aye.
We'd better not go home together.
I'll give you a half hour's start.
I don't like to leave you here, though I cannot doubt your being safer than near me. Goodbye.
Dear boy, I don't like goodbyes. Say goodnight.
When I had taken leave of the pretty, gentle, dark-eyed girl, I thought of Estella and of our parting and went home very sadly. The next day I set myself to get the boat round to the Temple Stairs. Sometimes with Herbert, often alone, I trained and practised. At first I kept above Blackfriars Bridge, but I soon learned to shoot the race and fall of water at Old London Bridge and so began to row as far as Erith. Although Herbert was at Mill Pond Bank rarely less than 3 times a week and never brought me a single word of intelligence that was at all alarming, still I knew there was cause for alarm, and I could not get rid of the notion of being watched. It was an unhappy life I lived. Convinced Estella was married, I begged Herbert never to speak of her to me. Condemned to inaction and a state of constant restlessness and suspense, I rowed about in my boat and waited, waited, and waited as best I could. There were states of the tide when, having been down river, I was forced to leave my boat at a wharf near the custom house, again serving to make me and my boat a common incident among the waterside people there. This I did one afternoon late in February, and from this slight occasion sprang two meetings. As it was a raw evening, I thought I would comfort myself with a meal in a chop house, and thence to a play at the theatre where Mr. Wopsle had achieved his questionable triumph.
Herbert! Herbert, listen, listen, listen to me!
My dear Handel, descend!
I've been to Wopsle's theatre.
Poor you!
Some nautical play of mind-numbing unimportance. Wopsle came on with a star and garter on us, some plenipotentiary from the Admiralty or some such, only to be immediately shoved into a corner while everybody danced the hornpipe.
Handel?
From which corner? I observed he devoted the spare time he had on his hands to staring in my direction as if he were lost in amazement.
So he would at you returning to the place.
He was waiting for me in the street outside afterwards.
I saw that you saw me.
I saw you, Mr. Pip. Yes, of course I saw you. But who else was there?
No one.
It is the strangest thing, and yet I could swear to him. Whether I should have noticed him at first, but for your being there, I can't be positive. And yet I think I should. I had a ridiculous fancy that he must be with you, Mr. Pip, till I saw that you were quite unconscious of him, sitting behind you there like a ghost. I dare say you wonder at me, Mr. Pip. Indeed, I see you do. But it is so very strange, you'll hardly believe what I'm going to tell you. I could hardly believe it myself if you told me.
Indeed?
Oh, no, indeed, Mr. Pip. You remember in old times, a certain Christmas day, when you were quite a child, and I dined at Gargery's, and some soldiers came to the door to get a pair of handcuffs mended?
Very well.
And you remember that there was a chase after two convicts, and that we joined in it?
Yes.
And that we came up with the two in a ditch, and that there was a scuffle between them, and that one of them had been severely handled and much mauled about the face by the other?
Yes.
Then, Mr. Pip, one of those two prisoners sat behind you tonight. I saw him over your shoulder.
Which of the two?
The one who had been mauled. And I'll swear I saw him. The more I think of him, the more certain I am of him.
I cannot doubt that he was there, because I was there, Herbert. I asked him how he was dressed, prosperously in black. Was his face at all disfigured? He believed not. He could recall no more, so I treated him to a meal and we parted. No one was near me when I arrived here, I swear. Herbert?
We must communicate this to Wemmick.
Yes, but might I not compromise him by going too often to the castle?
Then by letter. You write it, I'll go out and post it. Handel, we must be very cautious.
And we were more cautious than before, if that were possible. And I, for my part, never went near Chink's Basin, except when I rode by. And then I only looked at Mill Pond Bank as I looked at anything else. The second meeting occurred about a week later. I had once more left my boat at the wharf below the bridge, and, undecided where to dine, I strolled up Cheapside.
Mr. Pip!
Ah.
As we're going in the same direction, we may walk together. Where are you bound for?
The temple, I think.
Well, don't you know?
I don't know, for I have not made up my mind.
You're going to dine. You don't mind admitting that, I suppose.
No, I don't.
And you are not engaged?
I don't mind admitting also that I am not engaged.
Then come and dine with me. Wemmick is coming.
We went to Gerrard Street, and as soon as we got there, dinner was served.
Give Mr. Pip Miss Havisham's note, Wemmick. Now, you'll note it's a note of two lines, Pip, sent up to me on account of her not being sure of your address. She tells me that she wants to see you on a little matter of business you mentioned to her. You'll go down?
I have an impending engagement that renders me rather uncertain of my time. At once, I think.
So, Pip, our friend the Spider has played his cards. He's won the pool.
Yes.
As I said, he is a promising fella in his way, but he may not have it all his way. The stronger will win in the end. But the stronger has to be found out first. If he should turn to and beat her.
Surely you do not seriously think that he is scoundrel enough for that.
I didn't say so, Pip. I'm putting a case. Fellow like our friend the Spider either beats or cringes. Ask Wemmick.
Either beats or cringes.
So, here's to Mrs. Bentley Drummle. And may the question of supremacy be settled to the lady's satisfaction. To the satisfaction of the lady and the gentleman, it will never be. Molly! How slow you are today.
She was at his elbow when he addressed her, and a certain action of her fingers as he spoke arrested my attention.
What's the matter?
Nothing. Only the subject we were speaking of was rather painful to me.
The action of her fingers was like that of knitting. I looked at those hands, those eyes, that flowing hair, and I compared them with other hands, eyes, other hair I knew of, and what they would be like after 20 years of a brutal husband and a stormy life. And I felt absolutely certain that this woman was Estella's mother.
Oh, more wine, anybody? Molly, be sharp.
Wemmick, do you remember telling me before I first went to Mr. Jagger's private house to notice the housekeeper? A wild beast tamed, you called her.
And what do you?
The same. How did Mr. Jaggers tame her? I wish you'd tell me her story. You know what is said between you and me goes no further. I have good reason to ask.
A score or so years ago, that woman was tried at the Old Bailey for murder and was acquitted. Mr. Jaggers was for her and worked the case in a way quite astonishing. In fact, it may almost be said to have made him. The murdered person was a woman 10 years older, very much larger and very much stronger. It was a case of jealousy. They both led tramping lives, and Molly had been married very young over a broomstick to a tramping man and was a perfect fury in point of jealousy. The murdered woman was found dead in a barn near Hounslow Heath. There'd been a violent fight, and she'd been held at the throat at last and choked. There was no reasonable evidence to implicate anybody but Molly. But it was on the improbabilities of her having been able to do it that Mr. Jaggers principally rested his case. He never dwelt upon the strength of her hands then, though he sometimes does now. He dressed Molly in long, fragile sleeves. Bruises? Nothing for a tramp. But the lacerations on the back of her hands. She had struggled through a great lot of brambles, which didn't reach her face, and Jaggers provided the broken brambles. It was attempted to be set up in proof of her jealousy that she was under strong suspicion of having, at about the time of the murder, frantically destroyed her child by this man, some 3 years old, to revenge herself upon him. Mr. Jaggers work that beautifully.
We say these are not marks of fingernails, but marks of brambles. And we show you the brambles. You say they are marks of fingernails, and you set up the hypothesis that she destroyed her child. For anything we know, she may have destroyed her child, and the child, in clinging to her, may have scratched her hand. What then? You are not trying her for the murder of her child. Why don't you? As to this case, if you will have scratches, we say that for anything we know, we have accounted for them.
To sum up, Mr. Jaggers was altogether too many for the jury, and they gave in. She went into his service immediately. But she was tamed from the beginning.
Do you remember the sex of the child?
Said to have been a girl.
Come in.
There was an air of utter loneliness upon Miss Havisham as she sat near the hearth in a ragged chair, lost in contemplation of an ashy fire.
It is I, Pip. Mr. Jaggers gave me your note yesterday.
I want to pursue that subject you mentioned to me when you were last here, and to show you that I am not all stone. How much money do you need for your friend?
£900.
If I give you it, will you keep my secret As you have your own?
Quite faithfully.
Can I only serve you, Pip, by serving your friend? Regarding that as done, is there nothing I can do for yourself?
Nothing. I thank you for the question, and for its tone. But there is nothing.
This is an authority to Jaggers to pay you the money to lay out at your irresponsible discretion for your friend. My name is on the first leaf. If you can ever write under my name, I forgive her, though ever so long after my broken heart is dust. Pray do it. There.
Oh, Miss Havisham, I can do it now. There have been sore mistakes, and my life has been a blind and thankless one. And I want forgiveness and direction far too much to be bitter with you. To my amazement and terror, she dropped to her knees at my feet. I tried to raise her, but she hung her head over my hands and wept. I had never seen her shed a single tear before.
Oh, what have I done? What have I done?
If you mean, Miss Havisham, what have you done to injure me? Let me answer, very little. I should have loved her under any circumstances.
What have I done?
Is she married?
Yes. What have I done?
I knew not how to answer, or how to comfort her. And I couldn't look down upon her without compassion, seeing her punishment in the ruin she was.
Until you spoke to her the other day, and until I saw in you a looking-glass that showed me what I once felt myself, I did not know what I had done. What have I done?
Miss Havisham, you may dismiss me from your mind and conscience, but Estella is a different case. And if you can ever undo any scrap of what you've done amiss in keeping a part of her right nature away from her, it will be better to do that than to bemoan the past through 100 years.
But Pip, my dear, believe this. When she first came to me, I meant to save her from misery like my own. At first I meant no more. But then as she grew and promised to be very beautiful, I gradually did worse. And with my praises, and with my jewels, and with my teachings, and with this figure of myself always before her, a warning to back and point my lesson, I stole her heart away, and put ice in its place. If you knew all my story, you would have some compassion, and a better understanding of me.
Miss Havisham, I do know your story. Does what has passed between us give me the right to ask you a question? About Estella?
Yes.
Not as she is, but as she was when she first came here.
Go on.
Whose child was Estella? You don't know?
No.
Mr. Jaggers brought her here? Or sent her here?
Brought her.
Why?
I'd been shut up in these rooms a long time. I don't know how long. You know what time the clock keeps here. When I told Jaggers I wanted a little girl to rear and love and save from my fate. I'd first seen him when I sent for him to lay this place waste for me. I'd read of him in the newspapers before I and the world parted. He said he would look about him for such an orphan child. One night, he brought her here asleep, and I called her Estella.
Might I ask her age then?
2 or 3. She herself knows nothing but that she was left an orphan, and I adopted her.
What more could I hope to do by prolonging the interview? She had told me all she knew of Estella. I had said and done what I could to ease her mind. No matter with what other words we parted, we parted. Twilight was closing in when I went downstairs into the natural air. I wanted to walk around the place before leaving, for I had a feeling that I should never be there again, and I felt that dying light was suited to my last view of it. I made my way to the ruined garden. I went all round it, round by the corner where Herbert and I had fought our battle, round by the paths where Estella and I had walked. So cold, so lonely, so dreary all. Passing on into the front courtyard, I hesitated whether to leave, or first to go upstairs and assure myself that Miss Havisham was as safe and well as I had left her. I took the latter course, and went up. She was as I had left her, seated in the ragged chair upon the hearth close to the fire, with her back to me. In the moment, when I was withdrawing my head to go quietly away, I saw a great flaming light spring up, and in the same moment she was running at me, shrieking, with a whirl of fire blazing all about her, and soaring at least as many feet above her head as she was high. I had a double-caped greatcoat on, and over my arm another thick coat. I got them off, closed with her, threw her down, and got them over her. I dragged the great cloth from the table for the same purpose, and with it down cascaded the heap of rottenness in the midst, and all the ugly things that sheltered there. We were on the ground, struggling like desperate enemies, and the closer I covered her, the more wildly she shrieked and tried to free herself. Servants came in, but I still held her forcibly down, and I doubt if I even knew who she was, or why we had struggled, or that she had been in flames, or that the flames were out, until I saw the patches of tinder that had been her bridal dress, no longer alight, but falling in a black shower around us. By the surgeon's directions, her bed was carried into the room and laid upon the great table, which happened to be well suited to the dressing of her injuries. When I saw her again, she lay indeed where I had seen her strike a stick and had heard her say that she would lie one day. As I could do no further useful service, and as I had, nearer home, even more pressing reason for anxiety and fear, I decided in the course of the night that I would return to Garden Court by the early morning coach. At about 6 o'clock of the morning, therefore, I leaned over her and touched her lips with mine, just as they said, not stopping for being touched,
"Take the pencil and write under my name. I forgive her."
At first, as I lay quiet on the sofa, I found it painfully difficult, I might say impossible, to get rid of the impression of the glare of the flames, their hurry and noise, and the fierce burning smell. My left arm was a good deal burned to the elbow, my right not so badly that I could move the fingers. My hair had been caught by the fire, but not my head or face. Herbert was the kindest of nurses, and at stated times took off the bandages and steeped them in the cooling liquid that was kept ready, and put them on again with a patient tenderness that I was grateful for. Neither of us spoke of the boat, but we both thought of it.
I sat with Provis last night, Handel. 2 good hours.
Where was Clara?
Up and down with Gruff and Grim all evening. He's always pegging at the floor the moment she leaves his sight. I doubt if he can hold out long, though. What with the rum and pepper, I should think his pegging's nearly over.
And then you'll be married?
How can I take care of the dear child otherwise? Lay your arm out.
And Provis?
You know, he improves. You remember his breaking off about some woman that he'd had great trouble with? I hurt you.
No, I'd forgotten her.
He went into all of that. And a dark, wild past it is.
Tell me every word.
Here comes the cool one. Oh! It seems she was young, jealous, and a revengeful woman, Handel. To the last degree.
Last?
Murder.
Who did she murder?
The deed may not have merited quite so terrible a name, but she was tried for it, and your Jaggers defended her. Another stronger woman was the victim.
And the young woman was not brought in guilty?
No, she was acquitted. You start, I hurt you.
You couldn't be gentler. What else?
This young woman and Provis had a little child, of whom Provis was exceedingly fond. On the very evening of the strangling, the young woman sought out Provis and swore she would destroy the child and he should never see it again, then vanished. You seem to breathe quickly.
Did the woman keep her oath? Herbert?
That's better. Then came the darkest part of Provis's life. She did.
He says she did.
Well, of course. I have no other information.
No, to be sure.
Now, whether he felt pity or fear he should be called for knowledge about the destroyed child, he hid out of the way of the trial. There he was only talked of vaguely as a man called Abel, out of whom the jealousy arose. After the acquittal, she disappeared. Thus he lost both the child and the child's mother.
Did he...
A moment, my dear boy, and I've done. Compeyson knew all this and held it over Provis's head as a means of keeping him poorer and working him harder. That point barbs Provis's hatred.
Did he say when this happened?
How old were you when you came upon him in the little churchyard?
7, I think.
Yes. It had happened some 3 or 4 years then, he said, and you brought into his mind the little girl he'd lost, who would have been about your age.
Herbert, you're not afraid that I am in any fever, or that my head is much disordered by the accident of last night?
No, my dear boy, you're rather excited, but you're quite yourself.
I must go and clear this up with Jaggers.
Why?
The man we have been hiding down the river is Estella's father. That is exactly what happened at Miss Havisham's. And here are her tablets for the £900.
Draw the check, Mr. Wemmick. I am sorry, Pip, that we can do nothing for you.
Miss Havisham wished to help me, too. I told her no.
Well, every man ought to know his own business best.
Every man's business is portable property. Your check, Mr. Pip.
Thank you. I did, however, ask Miss Havisham to give me some information relative to her adopted daughter. And she gave me all she possessed.
Did she? She ought to know her own business best.
But I know more of her daughter's history than Miss Havisham herself, sir. I know her mother. I have seen her within these 2 days. And so have you, sir. Even more recently.
Yes.
Perhaps I know more of Estella's history than even you do. I know her father, too.
I assure you, I do not.
His name is Provis, from New South Wales.
And on what evidence, Pip, does Provis make this claim?
He doesn't. He never has. He has no knowledge or belief that his daughter is even alive. For once, Mr. Jagger's famous self-control failed him. Then slowly he folded his arms and stared at me with an impenetrable face while I told him everything I knew.
What item was it you were at, Wemmick, when Mr. Pip came in?
I will not submit, sir, to having the subject thrown off in that way. I am surely worthy of some little confidence from you in return for what I've just placed before you. Why do I want assurance of the truth from you? I know how little you care for such poor dreams, but I loved Estella dearly and long. Although I've lost her and must lead a bereaved life, whatever concerns her is still nearer and dearer to me than anything else in the world. Wemmick, I know you to be a man with a gentle heart. I've seen your pleasant home, your old father, and all the innocent, cheerful, playful ways with which you refresh your business life. I entreat you to say a word for me to Mr. Jaggers.
I've never seen two men look more oddly at one another than Mr. Jaggers and Wemmick did at my outburst.
What's all this? You with an old father? You with pleasant and playful ways? Pip, this must be the most cunning impostor in all London.
Not a bit of it. I think you're another.
You with a pleasant home.
Since it don't interfere with business, let it be so. Now I look at you, sir, after the first smile your way I've ever seen, I shouldn't wonder if you might be planning and contriving to have a pleasant home of your own one of these days, when you're tired of all this work.
Pip,
We won't talk about poor dreams. You know more about such things than I, having much fresher experience of that kind. But about this other matter, I'll put a case to you. Mind, I admit nothing. Say a woman, such as you've mentioned, held her child concealed, was obliged to tell her legal adviser for the purposes of her defense, and say that that same adviser held a trust to find a child for an eccentric rich lady to adopt and bring up. And say that adviser, living in an atmosphere of evil, saw pretty well nigh all the children he met in his daily business life end up being imprisoned, whipped, transported, neglected, cast out, qualified in all ways for the hangman, and growing up to be hanged. Say then, here was one pretty little child out of the heap who could be saved, whom the father believed dead and dared make no stir about, and as to whom, over the mother, the legal adviser had this power: give the child into my hands and I will do my best to bring you off. If you were saved, your child is saved too. If you were lost, your child is still saved. Say that this was done, and the woman was cleared. But say, the terror of death had shaken the woman's intellects, and at liberty she was scared out of the ways of the world, and went to the adviser to be sheltered, and he kept down her old, violent nature. And say, the child grew up and was married for money, that the mother and father were still living but unknown to each other, and their secret was a secret only you had wind of. For whose sake would you reveal the secret? The mother's? The daughters? Would you not rather chop off that hand of yours than bring her back to disgrace after an escape of 20 years? Now, Wemmick, what item was it you were at when Mr. Pip came in?
On leaving Little Britain, in no time I had concluded the arrangements for Herbert's future with Clarica. Clarica informed me Herbert would be sent to establish a small branch house in the East. I felt my last anchor with England loosening its hold. But there was huge recompense in Herbert's innocent joy at his fortune.
And the dearest Clara Handel, I shall conduct a brilliant princess to the land of Arabian Nights. And you shall come out and join us with a caravan of camels. And we'll go up the Nile and see wonders. Oh, Handel, Handel, my dear Handel.
Then, in March, a letter from Wemmick.
Walworth, burn this as soon as read. Early in the week, or say Wednesday, you might do what you know of if you felt disposed to try it. Now, burn.
I can't row with these hands.
I've been thinking. We can use Startop. A skilled hand, fond of us, enthusiastic.
How much would you tell him?
Very little. Let him suppose it a mere freak. Then on the morning say there's urgent reason for getting your Provis aboard and away. Where will you go?
Anywhere so that he's out of England. Any foreign steamer that will take us up will do. But we have to be beyond Gravesend if we want to be beyond searches.
We made full inquiries immediately, and found a steamer for Hamburg suited our purposes best. I then went to get passports, and Herbert to see Startop at his residence. It was agreed those two would row, I steer, and our charge would be sitter. As the others reported for work, I made my way back to Garden Court. Greeting me was another letter. Very dirty, though not ill-written.
If you are not afraid to come to the old marshes tonight, or tomorrow night at 9, and to come to the little sluice-house by the lime kiln, you had better come. If you want information regarding your Uncle Provis, you had much better come and tell no one, lose no time. You must come alone. bring this with you.
I resolved to go. The reference to my Uncle Provis coming fast on Wemmick's letter and the morning's busy preparation turned the scale. I left a note for Herbert saying I'd decided to hurry down and ascertain for myself how Miss Havisham was faring. By then I had barely time to reach the coach office, catching the coach just as it came out of the yard. Avoiding the Blue Boar, I put up at an inn of minor reputation in the town and ordered dinner. While it was preparing, I went to Satis House and heard Miss Havisham was still very ill, though considered something better. At 8, I had my coat fastened round my neck and sorted my pockets for the letter, but I couldn't find it, and was uneasy to think it must have been dropped in the straw of the coach. But I knew my appointed places, and I set out for the marshes. There was a full red moon above a ribbon of clear sky, but in minutes it disappeared into piled mountains of clouds. It was past a half hour before I drew near the kiln, its fires made up and left, the whole place burning with a sluggish, stifling smell. Then I saw a light at the sluice house. The abandoned, broken place was of wood with a tiled roof. There was a lighted candle on a table, a bench, and a mattress on a truckle bedstead.
Is there anyone here? Anyone here?
Then suddenly the candle was extinguished by some violent shock, and I was caught in a strong running noose thrown over my head from behind.
Gotcha! Who is it?
Not only were my arms pulled close to my sides, but the pressure on my bad arm was unendurable. A man's hand was set against my mouth, while I was fastened tight against the wall.
No. Call out again and I'll make short work of you.